the 13th century Persian poet with a message for our time.
This becomes extraordinarily relevant now that America's favorite poet or one of America's favorite poets is a Muslim and spent part of his life as a refugee and a migrant is, you know, an important irony for us to remember. I mean, Rumi was definitely someone who was always moving beyond labels towards what he called no name, and then, you know, racial divisions and religious divisions. So all this is, these are, you know, become very relevant.
That's Brad Gooch. We talk with him about his new biography of the poet Rumi, Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. Then, we've all heard of near-death experiences, going through a dark tunnel toward a brilliant, loving light. But what if your near-death journey is to the nether regions instead?
I knew I was dying, and then I knew I was dead. But the idea of myself dissipated. And suddenly, it was as if I was pulled down by seemingly my legs, but again, my subjective experience, into another realm. I was, to be frank, whatever my consciousness was, or whatever the consciousness was embarrassed slightly, because I knew where I was. And it was in the depths of hell.
That's Buddhist publisher and author Samuel Burkholz. He tells us about his graphic memoir, A Guided Tour of Hell. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Love trumps hate. It's a message we're hearing a lot these days, and not just because of the pun it contains on our new president's name. It's as if millions of us have awakened suddenly to the terrible danger of a country overtaken by hatred, and we're leaping to our feet to resist that odious tide and assert our common humanity. It feels like something we need to do if we're to survive these apocalyptic times. The Sufi Muslim poet Rumi also lived in apocalyptic times. The Mongol armies of Genghis Khan utterly laid waste to his homeland in Central Asia. He was a refugee and an immigrant, and he crossed not only geographical borders, but also the boundaries of conventional behavior. In a rigidly hierarchical society, he elevated the poor and uneducated. He befriended Christians and Jews. He respected women and their own right. And, most famously, his unconventional love for another man, Shams of Tabriz, became the inspiration for his poetry and his spiritual message of love. When my guest Brad Gooch first started researching the life of Rumi, he never imagined just how relevant to our own time his work would become. But as he became immersed in the project, he learned Persian and Farsi well enough to use his own translations of Rumi's poetry in the book, it became clear that the life of the 13th century poet had much to teach us moderns about how to survive turbulent times by following the path of love, not hate. Brad Gooch is a poet, novelist, and biographer. In addition to Rumi's Secret, he's the author of 10 previous works, including the memoir Smash Cut, the acclaimed biography of Frank O'Hara, City Poet, and Flannery, A Life of Flannery O'Connor. Well, Brad Gooch, welcome to Writer's Voice.
All right, great to be here. Thank you.
Rumi's Secret is the title of your book, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. Orient us first to his place and time.
Well, he was actually 13th century Persian poet, and he was born in Central Asia in what's now Tajikistan. But this was a very tumultuous period. The map of his life covers 2,500 miles. At a certain point, his family leave Central Asia. Then their homeland is destroyed by Genghis Khan and the Mongols. And Rumi really winds up a part of his life as a refugee and a migrant. And then finally is living in Konya, in what's now Turkey, where he dies in 1273.
A very turbulent time.
very turbulent time. I mean, even our time is maybe moving there, but it's so far pales. So especially because of the destruction of the Mongols, who were the terrorists of their time, in a sense, really wiped out certainly this Persian civilization that had been Rumi's homeland. Scholars now say that it constituted a genocide of the Persian population. You had all of these kinds of displaced mystics and poets and everyone else scrambling around. And then in a second wave, the Mongols attacked Baghdad and killed the caliph, who was sort of both king and pope. And, you know, many Muslims thought that, if you read the poetry and writing, they thought that this was the end of Islam at that point. So it was really an incredibly tumultuous period. And interestingly, though, in this period of dark political turmoil, then you also have this incredible exuberance in poetry and, you know, philosophy and mysticism and Sufism. All these activities were experiencing a kind of golden period.
Do you think there's a connection or not between the two?
I actually do. And then I also think, in how Rumi speaks to us now, you know, part of it is for the ages. I mean, he's kind of articulating the sound of one soul speaking, and this is always going to be audible, I think. But in another way, that the period, that in somehow his reaction to the period and the strength of his holding on to love and seeing connections between different people and different religions. I mean, all of this is extraordinarily relevant, and it was all part of his trying to survive, I think, not just physically, but morally and intellectually in this chaotic time.
Yeah, in fact, you talk about the resilience of Islam of his time and of Rumi himself. Mm-hmm. Say a little bit more about that resilience.
Well, he certainly, suffered a lot during his life and really found, had a very important encounter with Shams of Tabriz in the middle of his life that transformed him. So you had a kind of midlife crisis and transformation in Rumi. But all the poetry that we know really comes after that. So after 40 years of age, he writes, you know, over 3,000 ghazal, which are like sonnets, over 2,000 rubaiyat, which are like quatrains, a 6-volume spiritual epic in couplets, as well as talks. So he was a genius, and he was also using, though, poetry to try to, you know, work through his issues and survive and endure. And so his own, you know, resilience was connected to poetry as well as music and the whirling dance that we associate with him that he learned, I think, from Shams of Tabriz. So these were all, very vivid, necessary kinds of practices for him. And I think explanation of his resilience. And also at that time, and then he was part, though, of a wider culture. I mean, there were Sufi thinkers saying things similar to what Rumi was saying. There were Persian poets who were in creating pearly lines in a very beautiful period. So he was part of a culture in that way. And I do think that these, especially Sufi lodges at this time, were almost outposts for this kind of spirituality, mysticism, and then just the culture of music, song, and poetry as part of religious practice.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm talking with Brad Gooch about his biography of the 13th century Sufi Muslim poet Rumi. I asked Gooch how Rumi's writings had survived intact during so many centuries of conflict.
This is very interesting. I think it was almost accidental in a sense. Rumi, as an adult, lives in, as I said, Konya, Turkey, and it was part of a Seljuk empire, which was almost an outpost at that point of Islamic civilization. Probably no one called Rumi Rumi during his lifetime. The name meant from Rome, and that really meant because that part of the world was the old Roman Empire or the Eastern Byzantine Roman Empire. So the Seljuks in Turkey, where Rumi winds up, are living among a population that's mainly Christian, Greeks and Armenians, about 80% of that population. It's a kind of efflorescence of this culture, and the Seljuks really aspire to be Persian, so they brought in this culture, but then it's all destroyed. I mean, soon after Rumi's death, the Seljuk Empire falls, and all of that is quickly lost. So you would sort of think that would be it. Part of it is that Rumi's son and then his grandson start an order, the Mevlevi order, around Rumi and his teachings and the whirling dervish practice, much in the way that I think around St. Francis of Assisi, the Franciscans really grew as a codified order after his death. And so this continues through, and then at a certain point in Europe, Goethe, the Germans pick up, translate Rumi, and then in England you have what we now think of as Orientalists, but these kind of great Cambridge dons, Arbery and Nicholson, who spend their lives, devote their lives to translating Rumi's work. In America, the Transcendentalists pick up on him. Emerson translates a Rumi poem, and then eventually we get Robert Bly and Coleman Barks, closer to our own time, who retranslate Rumi in a kind of free verse, almost beat poetry mode in a sense. So somehow these poems have gotten to us. You could imagine it not happening at all, especially because of when we were talking about the tumultuous time. I mean, I traveled in that part of the world. I was in Aleppo then, where Rumi studied at college or madrasa, the day the Syrian civil war broke out. And I was in Iran a couple of times. Now no one can go to Iran. But just seeing Aleppo, which was kind of intact from Rumi's time, you could really see the 10th century tower and mosque and the bazaar. And that's been demolished, in the last few years. So when you see the kind of demolition and destruction that can take place in history, it's all the more remarkable that Rumi has made it through. But part of it is he was very much a public figure, almost a kind of saintly figure by the end of his life. And then when this order was put together, everything was preserved. I mean, anything Rumi wrote or touched in some way was preserved. A lot of it then was put away, such as his father's writings or the transcriptions of Shams of Tabriz talks. And these were not really found by scholars until the 20th century again. And they were in these Mevlevi kind of monasteries and libraries.
Well, that's such a fascinating story. So the word secret is in your title, Rumi's Secret. It seems to me like this is a many-layered word in your wonderful biography of the poet, the Sufi poet of love. Tell us some of the different meanings that secret means in this book.
Well, it's definitely one of Rumi's words, ser in Persian, which he loves and uses in many different ways, and almost has a kind of aesthetic of secrecy that has personal dimensions to him, has poetic dimensions, has religious, theological dimensions. One of the secrets, in a sense, is that he had this transformative relationship in the middle of his life with Shams of Tabriz. And at this point, Rumi is an established scholar. He has a family. He has posts at four different colleges. He's a jurist in the Hanafi school and, well-known and respected. Shams of Tabriz is a 60-year-old kind of outlier mystic who's been traveling around the Middle East in search of wisdom his whole life. And they meet and have this kind of electric friendship. And then they go into seclusion, first for 3 months, then for 6 months. At some point, Shams of Tabriz disappears from Rumi's life entirely. There are rumors he might have been murdered, probably not true, but definitely, you know, leaves without a trace. But we don't, and Rumi has then changed. I mean, he, as he said, love stole my prayer beads and gave me poetry and song. Mm-hmm. or when your love inflamed my heart, everything was burned to ashes except love. I put logic and learning and books on the shelves and learned the art of poetry and song. In all these ways, he's talking about the transformation in which he changed from sort of traditional preacher, teacher to a poet and mystic. But we don't know exactly what happened in seclusion between Rumi and Shams of Tabriz. I mean, this is always then finally of great interest to everyone and always a little mysterious. And especially later in his life in the Masnavi, Rumi's epic, he talks often about not saying the name of the beloved and how explanations make many things clear. Love is only clear in silence. So this kind of reticence and discretion and not naming is all very different from our culture today. But it's, in part of the personal secret of Rumi's life in a sense, right?
But how should we interpret that? We have this modern awareness of the rights of LGBTQ, of, people coming out. This is a relationship that was scandalous in a time when homoerotic relationships between men was totally accepted. Mm-hmm. What was different about this?
Yes, they did have a relationship that seems almost more modern to us. So the Persian civilization, first of all, the ghazal, these love poems, are usually written to boys, and they were usually cast as soldiers and wine stewards and things. And also in terms of education, there was on a kind of Plato-Socrates model, where there was an erotic charge to the teacher-student relationship, but it was sort of man-boy in that way. And that was all fine. Rumi and Shams of Tabriz had an unusual relationship, which they obviously describe as love, but it was never, even to them, clear who was the teacher-student relationship of it. So Shams of Tabriz at one point says, I need to know, are we teacher and student? Are we friend and companion? Rumi said that someone once said, I can't tell who's the lover and who's the beloved. Rumi was in his late 30s when he met Shams of Tabriz, and already a respected religious leader. Shams of Tabriz is 60. So the kind of almost equality or parity between them was really what I think upset people in a more traditional hierarchical society. They didn't actually fit, and also there was so much then chaos that ensued. I mean, Rumi had, because he was in middle age and he was successful, he had family, he had disciples, students, community. So all of this is put on hold in a way, which creates a lot of anxiety and confusion in everyone else. So there was a social disruption that occurred around Rumi's personal disruption because of the appearance of Shams of Tabriz. The other aspect, I think, is, and that's what's interesting about biography, is that the real story, in a sense, and actual people. I think if you were central casting, looking for a spiritual teacher, you would not come up with Shams of Tabriz. I mean, he was not the Buddha or something. I mean, there wasn't anything peaceful about him, and he was an irascible character, kind of misanthropic, had trouble getting along with his teachers. That was part of his wandering around, and didn't suffer fools lightly. was only interested in Rumi, really. So none of this, you know, like, he wasn't politic in the least, and was very interested in sort of honesty and openness between the two of them, and really would have liked, he said it many times, to have Rumi leave the, you know, this life and go, they would go off together and wander and travel. That had been Shams of Tabriz's life. That was the life that you would choose if you were a young mystic and poet. But, you know, Rumi had this midlife transformation. And so he was, part of his struggle is trying to resolve these two. So, I mean, all this, I think, is the source of the upset of that relationship.
Yeah, and you say, I think that was very striking to me how what Shams loved about Rumi was his authenticity and his honesty, something that was not part of social discourse at the time. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could talk about of how love itself broke Rumi open, as he mm-hmm. said. I don't know if that's part of Secret, but it does seem to me that that's part of the story that you tell here.
Yeah, it does, and it is part of Secret in a sense, that the way, I mean, Shams of Tabriz then disappears from Rumi's life, and that this separation is really what incites him to write poetry. And he has a period of, you know, near madness in a sense because of this, and goes off to search for Shams of Tabriz in Damascus. And you see him at this point, you know, working through how human love reconciles with divine love. Mm-hmm. And so he both whirls, in a sense, brings him closer to Shams of Tabriz, but also to God. And the poetry that he's writes then is always sort of simultaneously about human love and divine love. So, for instance, in Persian poetry, there's a convention called the takhallus, which is a kind of signature tag, where the poet puts his own name sometimes in the last line of the ghazal. Rumi, which is a complete innovation in Persian poetry, uses the name of Shams of Tabriz as his takhallus. And when these poems are first collected, they're known as the collected poems of Shams of Tabriz. But this, you know, he's not even saying that Shams is inspiring or influencing the poems. He's saying he is writing them through Rumi, that Shams is the poet in some way. Also, the name Shams means sun in Arabic. So when he's writing to the sun, is he writing to Shams of Tabriz? Is he writing to the natural sun that had been worshipped by the Zoroastrians? Is it subversive in that way? Or is he writing to the eternal sun god? And built into Persian language, the pronoun u can mean he, she, it, or God. So this is a game that Rumi plays to exhaustion. I mean, this is the motor of his poetry, really. And, you know, and then so finally, it's a very intelligent poetry. You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald said an intelligent person can hold two opposing ideas in their head at the same time. When you read Rumi's poems about love, I mean, you always have to kind of hold together at the same time the human love and the divine love. That's the nature of those poems.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Brad Gooch about his biography of the Sufi poet Rumi. It's called Rumi's Secret. It puts me in mind all of a sudden of a poem that I wish I had looked up before I came here today, but it's a very short poem, but there is a sense that it is in the interior contemplation that true union is made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that this eventually is the lesson, you know, that Rumi learns. There's a certain point during this period and is writing these Shams of Tabriz poems that he obviously seems to come to learn something or accept the death of Shams of Tabriz. He writes a very beautiful elegy. And And after that, his son records it in Rumi, does in different ways, that in Damascus he changed from being a pious man to being a mystic. But also in his own terms, he says that he comes to realize that what he was seeking is within himself, that Shams is within himself. And so this idea, this learning that the source of love is within himself, then is the wisdom that he gets.
Which is like the idea that God is within you. I mean, he really did seem to transcend a lot of the prejudices and limitations of the thinking of his age.
Yeah, I mean, in that there's a kind of genius that certainly the basics are there, right? So, and certainly in the Sufi interpretation of Islam, there was emphasis on the sections of the Quran that emphasize intimacy with God. So all of these ideas are there in some way, but they're at the same time, there is something about Rumi, as I think often with great mystics in all traditions, where he thinks outside the box in some way. He says, when you discover the source of sunlight, whatever direction you go will be east. Since we worship the one God, all religions must be one. In, these ideas were there in a certain way, but his expression of them kept going further, I think. An example that was slightly different is his daughter. He walked in and his daughter was mistreating a slave at one point, and he gets angry at her and he says, maybe I should write a fatwa against slavery. Well, this is kind of an audacious thought in the Middle Ages. So he was definitely capable of that. And at his funeral, there were not just reciters of the Quran, but singers and dancers and whirling, dancing and reciting of his poetry. But also in the procession were Christian priests reciting the gospel and Jewish rabbis reciting the Psalms. And we know that this was unusual because at a certain point his followers, who were enlightened Sufi types, had the funeral stopped sort of because they were sort of taking away their funeral or their leader. They didn't understand what was going on. This then was adjudicated by the parvane, sort of the governor, and the Christian priest said, well, you didn't understand who you had there, and you didn't realize how much time he was spending in Armenian neighborhoods teaching and talking to us. So there was a way in which his moving into being the interfaith icon that we see him as today came out of this tradition, and yet obviously he had, seen far beyond what many people of his time were seeing. And I think that's something that we respond to in his poetry.
Now, when we began this interview, you talked about the relevance of Rumi to what is going on today. And as we're talking now, it's just a few days after the President of the United States has instituted what seems to be a quite unconstitutional ban on people coming from certain Muslim countries into the United States. Give us the contemporary message that you would like readers of your biography of Rumi's Secret, to take away with them.
Mm-hmm. No, it is remarkable. The one way in which Rumi has survived is that he becomes reinvented almost for different periods. And for a long time in the 1990s, there was a huge Rumi craze. It was almost like the craze around Omar Khayyam in the 19th century. But people, I would ask them, they had no idea that Rumi was Muslim. They thought he was Buddhist, or no one, they never thought about it really. Or he was Cahil Gibran. No one really knew much about his life and the context of his life. And this becomes extraordinarily relevant now that America's favorite poet, or one of America's favorite poets, is a Muslim and spent part of his life as a refugee and a migrant, is an important irony for us to remember. And and also then there's a certain amount of his messaging is is harder. I mean, you can see the politics of lines like, well, if he is Turk or Tajik, I am close to him. I mean, Rumi was definitely someone who was always moving beyond labels towards what he called no name, and you know, racial divisions and religious divisions. So all this is, these are, you know, become very relevant and slightly fiery messages at this point. And then you have to ask yourself, so if Rumi was alive in Trump's America, what would he have to go to and register? Would he be, you know, stopped at the border? I mean, all of these things now, that context becomes very important now. And he talks about the religion of lovers all the time, and the religion of love, the only religion for lovers is God. So this message of unity is, through love, is the center of it.
And that's the secret.
That's the secret, yes. Right, yeah.
Well, this is just a fascinating biography. It's Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love. Brad Gooch, thank you. It's been a privilege to talk with you about it.
No, it's great to have an opportunity to have this kind of conversation. Thanks.
Brad Gooch's previous works include the memoir Smash Cut, the biography of Frank O'Hara, City Poet, and Flannery, A Life of Flannery O'Connor. You can read some poems by Rumi at writersvoice.net. Next up, A Journey to Hell with Buddhist publisher and author Samuel Burkholz. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Hell is other people, it's been said, but my guest Sam Burkholz says that's wrong. Rather, it's our illusion that we are separate from other people, and indeed from all sentient beings, that condemns us to hell. He knows. He's been there. He almost died during a severe heart attack, and during the 5 or so minutes that he spent straddling the border between life and death, he spent eons in hell with the Buddha of that region as his guide. Maybe he was chosen because, as a longtime publisher of Buddhist books, he's the founder of Shambhala Press, his life's work has helped countless readers on their own spiritual paths. What he found in hell is recounted and portrayed in his graphic memoir, A Guided Tour of Hell. Accompanied by the stunning illustrations of Pema Namdol Thaye, A Guided Tour of Hell is a Dante-esque exploration into realms of ice and fire. Those who find themselves there are racked by eternal torment, caused not so much by their deeds when they were alive, but by their thrall to the illusion of separation. Separation leads to rage, envy, judgment, and hatred. Emotions, according to Buddhist philosophy, that form the bedrock of suffering. Whether you view Burkholz's book as fact or metaphor, it's a cautionary tale that we all should heed for the sake of our souls. Samuel Burkholz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's nice to be here with you. Thank you so much.
This book, A Guided Tour of Hell, grew out of a near-death experience that you had. It wasn't the first, but it was also very different from the first one. I wonder if you could talk about both experiences.
Sure. Near-death experiences are weird. I don't know why they call them near-death, because you're actually dead. But then you come back and you're alive. So I guess since you haven't died, they're called near-death. But you did die. And I had an experience when I was about 25 years old. I had been in India, and somehow I'd gotten bitten by probably not a mosquito, but some vermin. And I developed a case of typhus fever, which is a rough disease, and it has an incubation period of about 2 weeks. So when I returned to America, I ended up in a hospital, and I was being treated for what they thought was malaria. And one day, my temperature went up to the point where you're supposed to be gone, and I was packed on ice, and I had the experience of leaving my body, and you know, it's the classic experience. There you are, you leave your body, some consciousness is floating at the top of the room, you see your dead body, you hear the doctors and nurses speaking, and there's a sense of relief because that which you usually hold so precious, your body, is in so much pain, it is, you know, a complete relief to leave it. And I experienced, you know, after that, you know, there's this sense of being there, and then my consciousness leaving through a tunnel of light. People have heard these experiences. They're very common. In my particular case, while I was in that state, I was apparently injected with something or whatever. They found out that I had typhus and not malaria and started treating me differently. And I came back into my body with a huge sonic boom-like explosion that was painful beyond belief. And, you know, I was alive and happily so. So that's the typical near-death experience. And I had that when I was in my 20s. And it did change my view of the world. I understood how impermanent my life was, you know, can disappear in a moment. Mm-hmm. And maybe it had some effect upon me. And I describe that first death in my book. But there was no idea of hell. There was maybe some heavenly idea of like following the light. And I remember looking at Doré's illustrations to Dante, and there is one that was, you know, almost exactly an artistic view of that experience that I could easily relate to as being, oh, yes, that happened to me.
You say the word consciousness. What was your sense or understanding of what consciousness is after that experience?
I don't really know because, you know, I was a 20-something year old. I had a lot of interest in philosophies of various kinds. I studied Western philosophies. I studied Eastern philosophies. In fact, the vermin that transmitted the typhus to me was transmitted in Bodh Gaya, where the historical Buddha attained enlightenment. And probably within a few yards of where he attained enlightenment, whatever that means. So there was some connection because I had gone to India on this combined book-buying trip. I was a bookseller and pilgrimage to Buddhist places and wanting to see the historical places of the Buddha, wanting to see the historical places in India that I was interested in.
And you certainly had a kind of short circuit to enlightenment there.
I don't know if it was a short circuit to enlightenment. I think it's what you'd call a short circuit to samsara, the endless cycle of life and rebirth.
Say more about that.
In Buddhist thought, the ordinary world as we know it, which includes our mind, is described as samsara, this constant circling through various realms. And these realms are psychological realms and physical realms. And they include all kinds of experiences, like the human realm being one of those experiences, and various heavenly realms and various other realms like animal realm and hungry ghost realm and hell realm. And from the Buddha's teaching, these various realms are viewed as the sort of psychodrama of our continuing life and death experiences, transmigration through these various realms. In Buddhism, unlike in Hinduism, there's an idea of rebirth rather than reincarnation, which is a constant sense of dying and being reborn, dying and being reborn. In fact, it's even said that, you know, when we go to bed, that's a kind of death, rebirth when we awake. And from one thought to the next is like a death and a birth.
So in a way, what you're saying is that this endless cycle exists on many levels, from the micro level that we may experience all the time, every day, to the death of our physical body.
Exactly. And there's no big differentiation between the death of a thought and the death of a body. Body is just another part of our so-called reality, but the one that we, you know, hold on to so preciously, because it's what attaches us to this earth. But earth is only one of the earthly realm. The human realm is only one of the realms from the Buddhist point of view.
So attachment, you know, many of us and many of our listeners, I'm sure, know that the idea of attachment and suffering are very closely aligned and very much part of this book, A Guided Tour of Hell, as well. So I wonder if you could give us a sense of what is the connection between attachment and suffering?
Well, it depends on what you mean by attachment. Attachment means different things for different people, actually. So we have attachment to people, mother, father, lover, son, daughter, and we have that can be like a positive attachment. And then we have negative attachments. You know, we're sitting here sort of at the bottom of Trump Tower, and so some people have very negative attachment to this tower and what it represents. And some people are out here on the street and have very positive attachment to it. So attachment can be the same phenomena, can have different attachment to people. Attachment means that there's some vested idea that goes with what we want to hold on to. And attachment's not necessarily a bad thing. I know that the people like to think, oh, it's good not to be attached. Well, there's no problem with being attached, actually, is what I've found, as long as you can let go. Attachment has a use. So you can be attached to a child, for example, you know, so you can care for a child, attached to a lover, so you can care for a lover. But with the attachment comes its exact opposite, non-attachment. So attachment and non-attachment can exist simultaneously. Attachment's only a problem if one gets stuck in it. But attachment is born and attachment dies, like everything else. It has an impermanent quality to it. So you can make attachment positive, you can make attachment negative, but regardless, you have to let attachment go.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Samuel Burkholz about his new book, A Guided Tour of Hell, a graphic memoir, and we'll get to the graphic part as well. But now let's talk about the book, because we've talked about attachment and letting go. I've mentioned the word suffering. Hell is a place of unbelievable suffering, certainly as you describe it in this book. Tell us about your second experience of a near-death experience and how different it was.
Well, my so-called second experience, I was in a hospital. I'd had sextuple bypass surgery, and I was recovering from it. And I was walking around the hallways with my nurses, joking about getting out of there, and I was going to get out the next day. And at one point, I suddenly sort of fall over. And apparently, I had been hit by what was described as possibly a blood infection. We don't know what it was. And again, not unlike my first near-death experience, there was a high fever or so on. I was put on ice. My vital signs went down to close to nothing. And my subjective experience, and I can only call it subjective because I have no idea what's objective, but my subjective experience was of death. And it was not a surprise, particularly. I'd seen other people die, and I knew what it looked like, but it was so quick. I don't know. It's a funny thing to talk about. And there was nothing, you can't prepare yourself for it. It's just what happens in that moment. Mm-hmm. And the things that I know, I knew I was dying, and then I knew I was dead. But the idea of myself dissipated. And then there was just the consciousness of what was about, rather than my identification with the consciousness. And suddenly, it was as if I was pulled down by seemingly my legs, but again, my this is a subjective experience, into another realm. And there was like a huge rush of being pulled into this, into these depths. And I arrived in this realm, or I say I, but there's, I have to use language of this world to describe language, to describe another world that exists not with the same set of circumstances as this world. So the circumstances of space and time, totally different. Mm-hmm. They really don't exist in terms of what we think of in dimensions. Consciousness doesn't really exist of what we think of in these dimensions, because there's no I to go back to, no body to go back to. And I was, to be frank, whatever my consciousness was, or whatever the consciousness was embarrassed slightly, because I knew where I was. Mm-hmm. And it was in the depths of hell.
And you thought, well, gee, I thought I was a good person all this time.
No, it doesn't quite work like that, but I thought, or whatever the thinking or the consciousness was, this is impossible. First of all, this does not exist. You know, I always thought of hell as being a fairy. Hell is, even in the Buddhist sense, of being like fairy tales for peasants. To be absolutely frank, even though I'm a very faithful practitioner of Buddhism and so on, I'm one of the biggest skeptics that ever lived. And all those sections about the realms and hell and so on, you know, I read a lot of books, and a lot of Buddhist books have these sections, and I would always take those sections, pull all those pages together, and flip them. And that's for peasants. So I had an aversion to these sort of tales. But then I found myself in the middle of this realm, and I was, this is how I describe it, I was met by the Buddha of hell, and assured that I wasn't a denizen of hell, but that I was here to be shown the suffering of beings.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Sam Burkholz about his graphic memoir of a near-death experience, A Guided Tour of Hell. I also had a hard time wrapping my mind around this. I mean, to me, it felt like this is metaphor. These are lessons for us. So I'm not sure I can even go where you went, because it's not something I've experienced. But whichever it is, well, you know, however people experience your book, whether they experience it as a metaphor or they experience it as some real place, describe the suffering and the cause of the suffering, because you do say that there are some common elements to all the different kinds of suffering that you saw the denizens of hell go through.
In hell, so to speak, because we you know, I'm describing this as hell. Mm-hmm. When I came back, I don't know if it was my wife that was there or my son. I think it might have been my son. I immediately related to him that while I was away, by the way, I was in hell. And he looked at me sort of incredulously, and he said, Dad, good thing. I read that most experiences in hell last for eons. Yours was only a few minutes. However, in the sense of subjective time, it was more like a few aeons. But in terms of a hospital time, it was 5 minutes at most. But I was shown a complete universe, so to speak, and a vast variety of details within that universe. Now, when I landed in hell, I didn't quite understand that I had ended up in the palm of the Buddha of hell's hand. And I'm using metaphor here. I can't say what actually happened because it's beyond saying. But because I have to say, it was, you know, this experience of being within this kindness, compassion, and the kindness and compassion manifested as fire, and it manifested as water. So any consciousness that I had was this interplay of this duality of fire and water.
So what were some of the common elements of the suffering of those who you experienced there, and how you know, who did you see?
The most common element is duality. That is the message, so to speak, of the hot and the cold. It's unified in the Buddha's hand, which is in an awakened view of it. There is no separation between duality. So duality is the simple way that the mind works that differentiates some idea of an individual self from everybody and everything else. The bugaboo of hell and the bugaboo of all suffering is separating oneself from anything else, in fact. Mm-hmm. It's creating this self-referential phenomena that we call me. And it's only a problem if we make it a problem. It's just a tendency. We're human beings. We have this tendency to self-reference. However, if we make that self-referencing solid by repeating it endlessly, by repeating all kinds of lies, including the lie that I am separate, we believe this separateness. So at the core of the hell experience, at the core of suffering, is separating this idea of me from whatever happens in life, including pain, including pleasure, including what we might hold on to. Some people view ego as a problem. Ego is only a problem if you believe it. It's usable. There's so many usable things. Duality is only a problem if you believe it. There is something very practical about that and this.
It's like we have individual bodies, but we know from physics that we're mostly empty space.
Exactly.
And yet those people in hell are stuck in those thoughts. They never end.
Exactly.
And so give us a for instance of somebody that you experienced in hell.
In hell, there are countless numbers of beings. Each being in hell views their situation as being the absolute worst situation and pays no attention to the fact that there are all these multiple numbers of suffering beings that in fact may be suffering much more than them. All they care about is their own suffering, their own pain, and so on. And, you know, like, oh, woe is them that they got here. And some of them, of course, there's no woe. They, you know, they may have been powerful figures in life. And, you know, it's just like they may actually gloat at the fact that they're there in hell suffering and so on. But it's all this reference to some solidity, you know, but they're a bunch of zombies. They're not alive. They're dead. There is no life in hell, but there's no death in hell either. The suffering doesn't die.
And so the root of the suffering is duality?
The habit of duality. Duality, from this point of view, doesn't really exist. Duality is something that people, quote-unquote, experience. And it's how they experience it, whether they subscribe or whether they don't subscribe, has so much to do with it. It's about habit. And the habit can take on different forms. Like in life, we have various habits like drugs, emotional habits, all kinds of habits. So duality and habits are totally connected. So we have duality habit, which is always separating ourselves out from phenomena. And then we have this other strange phenomenon of reality habit, always trying to materialize everything as being quote-unquote real, and that which isn't completely material and provable doesn't actually exist. So we have these strange habits that fight with each other. The beings in hell, because they're stripped of their bodies, they're dead, create illusory hell bodies that sort of approximate what they think of what they should look like. But it never works out because there's nothing, there's no, hell is immaterial. It just feels material because of this attachment to the ideas of so-called reality and the habit of me and everything else.
So it seems to me that what you're really saying is illusion is the key to hell, that the illusions we have about separateness or the illusions we have that if we just do this, everything's going to be okay or it's going to feel fine, that it's somehow in that sense of, you've said the word wishful thinking over and over again, that that's where hell lies.
Yes. Hell lies in not paying attention. It really is comes from not only not paying attention to others, but not paying attention in a nasty way, even though it may not seem nasty. It's like wiping out whole aspects of humanity through some sort of inner prejudice, for example, or trying to create oneself as superior to other beings, not seeing the common humanity. All beings suffer. That's what we beings have in common. And it depends on how we work with the suffering. If we develop kindness and compassion, or we develop avarice and looking down upon. If we develop avarice and looking down upon, then we end up in the hell of being the one who is looked down upon and the one that is constantly hurt.
Sam Burkholz, we've run out of time for the rest of this broadcast, but there's much more of the conversation with Sam Burkholz at writersvoice.net. Listen to the entire interview about his memoir, A Guided Tour of Hell, and you can also see some of the amazing illustrations to the book. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.